Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
You are listening to Troubadours and Raconteurs with E.W. Conundrum Demure on Radio Free Brooklyn. Welcome to episode 270 of Troubadours and Raconteurs with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. On this week's episode, we feature a very nice conversation with one of our great contemporary composers, librettists, Richard Wargo. We talk about his process, how he got into music, opera. We talk about early influences and the importance and value of music and art in a community, in the country, in the human experience. It's a great conversation this go around with Richard Wargo. We have an EW essay titled Listen. We have another finely crafted and beautifully read original essay written for us by our associate producer, Dr. Michael Pavese, a.k.a. Uncle Cesare. It's titled Screamers and Smurls. We have a poem called Fable. And as is always the case, of course, we will be sharing with you the wonderful music of several great artists. Let's get to it. Episode 270 of Troubadours and Raconteurs.
I got a dirty, dirty feeling. Dirty feelings going on. You know I almost hit the ceiling. When I woke up and you were gone. I took you in when you were hungry.
Listen. And Atlas shrugged as another conservative human policy proves itself to be inhumane, especially for the urbane. And those who are completely content with a catchy turn of phrase let themselves be amazed by the otherwise empty hyperbole. While fellow citizens are treated like denizens, and no matter the proof compiled to communicate clear the injustice, nothing seems to rile these drones to admit their mistakes and missteps. The humility, wisdom, and courage of kindness are not there. Reticence is the way of the smug and impatient. Anger at being proven wrong, while melodrama becomes instead the strong arm of those controlling the narrative to further control the throngs, defining the daily mores of our society. How has this gotten so wrong? Yet, as I write this lament, the shine of our star sun basks me with rays of pure energy as several churches in my neighborhood ring their bells, for it is another noontime celebration despite the depressing focus I share and fear I wear, so steadfast and righteous. I guess I might be on to something. The birds whistle and chirp beautiful spring melodies for any to hear who listen.
Standing by your window in pain, pistol in your hand, and I beg you, dear Molly girl, try and understand your man the best you can. Across the great divide, just grab your hat and take that ride. Put yourself on ride and bring your children down to the riverside. I had a goal in my younger days, I nearly wrote my will, but I changed my mind for the better. I'm at the still.
Hello, Richard Wargo. Is that you?
This is me.
Oh, so nice to have you on the program. E.W. Conundrum here from Troubadours and Rock on Tours.
Oh, it's great to be. Great to be part of it. Thank you for asking me.
Oh, we're going to have a good time talking with you today. Let me first share with our listeners a bit of your background, if you don't mind.
No, not at all.
Richard Wargo is a composer, librettist, has been lauded by the Philadelphia Inquirer as, quote, a fresh new voice in American opera, and by Opera News as, quote, a born opera composer, a native of Scranton, Pennsylvania, and a graduate of the Eastman School of Music. He is a two-time recipient of the Belen Arts Scholarship. He has received grants from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the PA Council on the Arts, and a fellowship from the Theater Communications Group to serve as composer-in-residence at the Skylight Opera Theater in Milwaukee, where his opera Ballymore, based on Brian Friel's play Lovers, was premiered in 1999 and recorded for PBS. Recent performances of Ballymore include productions by Wexford Festival Opera in Ireland and by Chelsea Opera in New York City. Mr. Wargo's opera, A Chekhov Trilogy, was premiered by Chautauqua Opera in 1993, and since then has received numerous performances, including productions of the trilogy's third segment, The Music Shop, by the Juilliard School and by Opéra National du Rhin in Colmar, France. A workshop performance of his current project, Sharon's Grave, was presented jointly by the Siegel Music Colony and the Sembrich Opera Music in the in the summer of 2015. Mr. Wargo is a member of the ASCAP. During the summer months, he serves as artistic director of the Sembrich Opera Museum in Bolton Landing on Lake George, New York. Thank you so much, Richard Wargo. It's nice to have you on. And let's get right in. I want to ask you, sir, I mean, you're one of the most accomplished opera composers contemporary today in the United States of America, as far as I understand it. And I want to know how you became interested in music. How did it all start?
Well, I think, and you know, growing up in this area, it's all around us here in Northeast Pennsylvania. Probably the most fortunate thing for our family is that my aunt Anne, my father's sister, was a musician. She played piano, she played organ, and she sang in the local opera group. And she kind of encouraged my parents to bring a $50 Beckwith piano into the house. And it was that kind of was the doorway for all of us to have access to music. Otherwise, I may have been a fiction writer or something. But it was that piano. You know, you hear a lot of times people say, oh, it's good to have a piano in the house. Well, in our case, it really paved the way for all of us. My sister, she didn't continue in music, but she enjoyed music and sang and continues to do that down in Philadelphia. My older brother, Jack, is a really pretty well-known rhythm and blues guitarist. And my younger brother, Ed, is a really fine classical flutist. So all of us kind of, because of that $50 Beckwith, it really paved our future in some ways.
Great investment, for sure. And so,
it was interesting too that my grandmother we're working class in Southside, but you know, she would always bring these records from the Goodwill, and there'd always be some treasures in there, and it was just having that music around. And then in the teen years, I mean, we had, I think at the time you don't fully appreciate it, but you know, Beverly Sills came through town, and Domingo and the Budapest Philharmonic through the community concerts. And one thing that was really fortunate for a lot of the young people in the mid-70s was after the Agnes Flood, there was some funding to establish a youth orchestra with the Philharmonic. And I was a part of that from day one and continued until I went to the Eastman School of Music. And after I graduated Eastman, I came back and I worked on the staff, and they commissioned two pieces from me. So, again, music, there were so many opportunities here in Northeast PA when I was growing up and still today. And I was really fortunate to have access to all of them.
Yeah, you know, I've always noticed that too. As you mentioned, the two of us are raised in the same community, it is steeped in the arts. It has been, and you take it for granted until you go outside the area and you see that it's not this way everywhere. I mean, of course, in a cosmopolitan, metropolitan area like New York City, sure, but I mean, most towns are not like New York City, of course, nor is Scranton. But compared to many, many, many towns and small cities in this country, we have a high concentration of cultural activity going on.
Oh, most definitely.
Now, when did it dawn on you, and why do you think it did, that, hey, you know what, I think I'm going to be a composer?
Well, I think it just was a gradual process. I mean, the whole idea of telling stories, I mean, as far as I can remember, you know, like all of us, you know, learning stories and relating things like that. And I think the idea that music has the potential to heighten a particular character, a story. And so realizing that, I would add music to the stories, or I would go out of my way to have opportunities to explore this area. For instance, when I was a sophomore at prep, I volunteered to write a score for the production of Antigone, and I would do that throughout my high school and college years. I'd volunteer my services. So by the time, you know, I was like my early 20s, I had an opportunity, and I figured this was, not only was I drawn to do it, but I was thinking it was a way to express the themes of the plays in music, and something that I wanted to carry further with opera. But sort of to train for that, I did scores for the Second Story Theater production of Mice and Men, for the University of Scranton's production of Oedipus, for a production of Night of the Iguana. So all of these plays and this great literature, I had an opportunity to explore as a kid, you know, just trying to find how does music fit with this, and how to tell a story through music. So I think, to get back to your question, the whole notion of telling stories, expressing the emotions of a character through music, was something that appealed to me, you know, through my teen years, and something that I'm continuing to this day as an opera composer.
Well, yeah, and that's just it, an opera composer, which, you know, first of all, going back to your teen years, a lot of guys would just then play rock and roll music, or maybe get most would go rock and roll. Maybe some go into jazz, yeah, or something, but you went a different path, the scores.
I was so square. And my brother, you know, my older brother, Jack, you know, I think he's, because he did that path, and he was very successful with that, and loved that path. But for me, for some reason, it was the classical music and the theater music that I heard that moved me most.
Now, when you get into opera, your characters, you get to create characters. You get to create stories, and the characters come to life through words as well as the music. You're composing all of that, right?
And a lot of people ask, you know, I in a sense, I wish that there was a librettist I could work with. But I mean, if you were to read like some of the letters of Puccini and Verdi, and they were taskmasters with their librettist, and they, in a way that artistically you really can't be today with the poet. It's a whole different work environment than it was back then. But essentially, what a composer needs is to be able to control the pacing of a piece. And so if you can imagine, I mean, I've had really fine, I've met, you know, fine poets that have words that stand on their own, that they don't particularly need music. So the idea of the words for an opera, as a composer, if I write the words, and I'm not too great with words, but I have control over the pace, over the rhythm of a scene, and I can make things move along in an easier way than rather than going to a librettist and saying, no, you have to cut these four lines, and I need this, that, and the other. And to this day, there are really fine writers for the theater who work that way. I'm not saying that it doesn't exist, but it's really hard to find that partnership where you have a trusting relationship with another writer where you could say, yeah, I know those are your four best lines, but they need to go because the scene needs to move along here. So that's the kind of dynamic that if I had a librettist, we would work that way. The fact that I'm my own librettist, I work that way kind of privately on my own. But it's the whole, at the end of the day, it's the whole notion of making the piece work. And I think this is a lot of growing up with musicals around here as well. I mean, I'm as much interested in musical theater as opera. It really is very interesting to see how the musical theater composers of our day have worked. I saw you at a production of Sunday in the Park with George,
right,
at Murraywood, and of course that was written with all of these, you know, back and forth between words and music and staging and writing, and it's just kind of like you have to get your hands dirty and get in there and make it, you know, make it work, make it live on the stage.
Well, and the editing part, you know, you and I have a mutual friend who is our associate producer, Dr. Michael Pavese. He, you know, he's a huge proponent of editing, you know, doing it right, but you have to edit, you know, otherwise things get too verbose, too wordy, too unwieldy, and things and your ideas don't communicate well.
Sure. That's it's so important. Yeah.
And for those of us who do not know, a librettist, what exactly is the, can you give us a little insight as to what a librettist is?
Well, I mean, of course, with any opera or even the musical, you have the words and the music. So a librettist for opera would be like the lyricist for the entire opera as it goes along. And the important thing is that if you think to sing something, that again, that's heightened speech, it takes longer than to speak it. So on average, the real gift of a good librettist is to really distill the drama, really down to the most essential words and actions. And actions is really important too, because sometimes something that you might think of doing in a novel or a play would be fine, but if you could find a way to express it without words and dramatize it with music or with just a few words of music, that's really the mark of a really fine librettist. And that's really the skill of really distilling the essence of a drama down to its very essential parts, and then letting the music and words together illuminate it in a very theatrical, dynamic way on the stage.
Well explained. Thank you. Richard Wargo here on the program. He's a composer and librettist and an all-around great guy. Let's hit you with another question. Sir, share with us a little bit your process when composing a piece.
Well, that's really interesting. You know, I've found that as many hours as I've spent in libraries and going through bookstores looking for ideas, sometimes the ideas just come to you. So the first idea, you know, the whole idea of inspiration, in my case, in particular writing for the theater, is often seeing something. An example, I was 17 when I saw a production of Brian Fields' play Winners at Grand Central. And it just stayed with me for years and years until finally I went to Brian Friel in Ireland and I got his permission to turn it into an opera. Another case was I went to the Scranton Public Theater and I saw part of the play The Good Doctor by Neil Simon. And, you know, even though everybody said, oh, Neil Simon won't answer your letters, don't write to him, I just felt drawn to try and get permission, you know, for that one bit. But aside from permissions and all of those technical aspects that go into, you know, the writing, the actual composing process is you get an idea, and then let's say it's an opera, it's a theater piece, and you find that the musical moments, the high points that you want to concentrate on, and then you build around those. In case of an opera or a musical, it's a song or an aria being the classical song. And often, this is the way I work anyway, often you find those key moments, and sometimes you even start with them. You just dive right in. You start in the middle of a piece, and then you try to find the melodic essence of that particular theme or whatever that is. And in the case with me, like I'll work on, there might be a phrase in the actual play that will lend itself to a melodic theme. This, you know, a little theme, and then from that you build the words and you build the scene around it. And sometimes there are just those little motives that, you know, little musical ideas that surround the aria that you discover and you can take and you can build the scene around it. And it's really a whole process of discovery. It's sort of maybe putting a puzzle together in a sense. And then always having your eye on the pacing and the mood and keeping it, you know, vital and all of a piece, you know, that whole editing process, just making it work together. It's really, in a sense, you know, it's hard to even describe the process. But it goes on for a while like this. You work on the music, the words, and then somewhere along the way you have an opportunity to hear some of it. And this is so essential. And I've been very fortunate to have other opera workshops and such that give you opportunities to hear a portion of a piece like this. And then from that, you continue to build on it and build on it. And then somewhere along the line, somebody comes and says, oh, we'd like to do your opera, and you know, with orchestra, and which is a real gift because that's a rare opportunity. And then, or even not then, even if you don't get that offer, you orchestrate it. You take the themes that, let's say if you're looking at, if you're familiar with like a piano vocal score, you have the melody line on the top, and the bottom you have the musical ideas that accompany that in the piano. Essentially what that is, that those two staves that have the music, that's really the orchestra. So what you have to do then is take that and decide, or if you haven't already decided what these instruments are, and fill it out to these, you know, expand it to its orchestration. And that orchestration could be a string quartet, it could be a full symphony orchestra. But in any case, then the next process is orchestrating and then putting it all together over, and this is why, you know, this is why operas take years to write, or sometimes not just years to write, but it might, you might have a piece for voice and piano and it's done, but to have the opportunity and to hear it with the full orchestra. Sometimes it's a long process, so you have to be patient.
That was a wonderful explanation. You anticipated about four questions I was going to ask you. And you answered them.
I'm sorry to rush ahead.
No, perfect. Perfectly done. Yeah. That leads me to another one, though.
Right.
Does the way you imagine it would sound when you're putting it together, when you hear it in your head, so to speak, come close to how it actually does sound when a symphony orchestra is interpreting it?
Well, you know, that's probably the most exciting part of a composer's process. I mean, it really is, and it's all too rare, at least, you know, in my case, writing these operas that often they're done with piano and they take a long time to write, but it's so exciting. Like, even I'm thinking back to the times I've had pieces done by the Philharmonic. It's like a 60-piece orchestra on stage, and I've always thought like orchestrating, which I love doing, but it's akin maybe to painting in the dark or in very dim light, and you sort of know how it's supposed to look, and it is, but when you have that orchestra on stage and the conductor with the baton, then it's like the lights are turned on, and it's not just you there, it's the whole orchestra and whoever else is around, so it's a really public unveiling, and, you know, enormously exciting that first time you hear it, and usually it's sort of like you imagine, but maybe a little bit heightened, because you imagine it, but you can never really fully imagine what the sound is going to be. And there are always these one or two little areas where you know, you let the strings stop and you say, oh, why did I put off that chord there? And then you go back and you fix those things. But it's really one of the most exciting parts of the composition process, is just hearing it for the first time with the orchestra. And in the case of an opera with the singers and the orchestra, boy, that's really, you know, and those are the fun, you know, those are probably the highlight of being a composer. Then when you start, you know, the audience comes in, and then you're like a wreck, and then you don't really fully enjoy it. You have to hand it over to the public and to everyone else, and I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but it's fraught and filled with anxiety, and, you know, I mean, if I have a run of an opera or something, and I stand in the back, and if people are like, you know, restless in their seats, I'm thinking, oh, well, this is not, something's not working here, or if anybody coughs, I'm thinking, oh, you know, I take it personally. So it's those moments when you're still working on the piece and when it's, you know, unveiled before you and your colleague, the orchestra and the singers, that are really the joy of being an opera composer. And the other still is. I'm not discounting that, but I'm just saying a lot of other elements come into play when suddenly it becomes public. You're kind of like, you're out there for everybody to.
Oh yeah, you're in many ways. I mean, you're burying yourself. It's a very vulnerable
Correct.
Position to be in, for sure.
Yeah.
What would you say, Richard? Are the aspects of your human experience that most reveal themselves in your work?
Well, I think just getting back to the idea of giving voice to particular characters and all, I think when you look at what, I mean, ultimately, the pieces that stay with me for all these years, I see something and I'm drawn to want to express it in music. So that, I guess that would reveal. I think artists in general have to, when you see the world and you want to give voice, let's say, or here's an example. I was in Ireland and I saw a play by John B. Keane, and the lead character was the most despicable person you could imagine. Just, you know, full of wit, but just rancorous and nasty. But at one point in the play, he suddenly revealed his whole soul on stage, and it was a moment theatrically on the stage in a play. Again, no music here. I'm thinking, well, this needs to be sung. This is something that. You know, I really would love to. That I was totally drawn to, and you know, ultimately I got permission to adapt this play, and this is what I'm working on now. But I think it's just a sense of a compassion for people and wanting to express them and give voice to these different characters. Another thing that occurred to me too. I mean, getting back to the play that I mentioned, I saw at Scranton Central when I was 17. And I didn't really realize this at the time, but I think what really drew me to that was that it's a play told in two different times. There are young lovers, I mean, the plot of the play, there are young lovers on a hillside, and they're there for one day, and they think they have the whole world before them, but the audience discovers that it's their last day on Earth, that they're doomed to die in a boating accident. And the way the audience discovers this is that there's another separate plane. There are two characters that are sort of overseeing narrators, and they talk about the temperature of the day, and they talk about things that these young people are unaware of. And basically, it's sort of like the here and now of our everyday lives, and then this vast eternity that these other characters represent. And I think, and part of the point of the play is that I think Brian Friedel was trying to get us to wake up and look, you know, to stay, to realize the bigger picture. And I think that whole idea of the bigger picture is something that a lot of artists strive for. So separately from that particular opera, the power in music, I think, to transcend the daily life, the daily details that we think about every day, and cause us to maybe stop for a moment and see the larger picture. I mean, I don't know if that makes any sense, but I think it's something that artists strive for and want to at least try to express, that you know, the wonder of everything around us, separate from, you know, all of our daily chores and tasks, you know, to stop and I think that's the power of classical music in general, is to give us that moment to look beyond ourselves and our daily cares and such.
Wonderfully explained. Yeah, that makes total sense to me, of course. And that is the beauty and the power of art for me as well. You really summed that up wonderfully. Thank you. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
You are listening to Troubadours and Raconteurs with E.W. Conundrum Demure on Radio Free Brooklyn.
Oh, no, it just, that whole notion, it really brought to mind a recent performance I heard here locally. The Arcadia Chorale produced the St. Matthew Passion recently. They did it in Wilkes-Barre, St. Stephen's. And here's this massive piece. It's a cathedral of a work. And it was 4 hours in length. And it had two choruses, two orchestras, soloists. And it was really interesting to, aside from being just a magnificent performance, to just sit there in the midst of this packed church, St. Stephen's in Wilkes-Barre, and see everyone so intently together and concentrating on this one thing. There was not a blue screen anywhere. And it really made me aware of it's rare to have that communal experience of all these musicians and audience alike just so intent on one thing for 4 hours. It was sort of, afterwards I realized, wow, that's
inspirational.
That's the first in quite a while. You know?
Yeah, I love those kinds of experiences as well.
Yeah.
Richard, we only have a minute or two left. I want to ask you what we could be looking forward to coming from you soon, you know, or even in the long term. What are you hoping to get out there in the way of new compositions, new pieces?
Yeah, well, I'm still working on my opera Sharon's Grave, and I've had the opportunity through the Seagull Colony up on Lake George to work on that, and they're interested in going further with that. So that would be the long-range big project, and ultimately to go through that whole process we talked about earlier, you know, having workshops and orchestrating it and having a premiere somewhere down the road. And then as artistic director of the Marcella Simbrook Opera Museum, I meet so many really fine musicians. I run a summer music series, and as a matter of fact, you had one of our musicians, Alberto Villalobos, on your program.
Yes, he was fantastic. Fantastic.
Yeah, and you know, there's so many great people. I want to work with them, so I'm thinking of maybe trying to write some smaller pieces for these folks that I meet, and perhaps have them perform either on Lake George, where I worked in the summer, or maybe even locally here. So, and then the other task is try to get some of my pieces that are in need of recopying things and everything. I'm not at all technically savvy, so these days everything needs to be in certain computer programs and all, so I need to catch up with some of that too. So that's basically it. One long-range opera, some smaller chamber pieces, and then trying to step into the 21st century in terms of the materials and the technology that I'm kind of been remiss with.
And if people want to keep track of when some of these new projects will be available for public consumption, how would they do that?
Well, see, this is where I'm remiss in terms of I don't have Facebook and such, but you can. I would actually invite people to check out the website for the Simbrook Opera Museum, and because you can always email me through there, or you know, this. Certainly, I'll include news of anything like that on that website. And that's www.thesembrick.org. That's S-E-M-B-R-I-C-H. And that's where I spend my summers. And if anybody from Northeast PA is heading up to Lake George, just, you know, Google Opera Museum and you'll find me up there. And come and visit, because it's a beautiful, beautiful spot to be, as is. But as beautiful as that is up there on Lake George, and that's where I'm hosting all of these musicians, and I'm on duty as an impresario and an artistic director, I always love when the fall comes and I can come back to downtown Scranton, where I have a wonderful studio, and spend my fall, winter, and spring here in Scranton.
And that's where you are right now as we speak, in your studio in downtown Scranton.
I am. I'm looking out the window. I see the courthouse, and, you know, it's a beautiful day, and the hills all around. This is where, you know, sometimes people inquire, oh, well, why do you live in Scranton? And I just say to them, why not? What a beautiful spot we're so privileged to have. And, you know, the quality of life here, I found, I've lived in lots of cities, and the quality of life here, I think we don't fully appreciate. I mean, it's just so, so excellent, and that's why I just always enjoy coming back here, spending as much time as I can here.
I surely am happy that you do. It's nice to cross paths with you in town, and it's really a wonderful treat to talk with you on Troubadours and Rock on Tours. Richard Wargo, one of our premier composers, operatic in particular, in the country. Thank you so much, Richard. We'll see you out and about, and I look forward to some new work very soon.
Thank you so much. Appreciate your inviting me on.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Talk with you soon. Ciao.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Before lunch, I love this view of Ballymore. The time. up here looking down on them, I start to feel reflective and philosophic.
Philosophic.
Up here, everyone's dear and gracious. Down there, they're all an enlightened and tall. Up here, I want to run down and hug and kiss them all. Down there, I'd rather do that into their faces. Sometimes I bet that's just how God feels, wouldn't you say?
I don't know how God feels.
Why not?
Because I'm not God.
When I tell you something, there are occasions in my life when I know how God feels.
Good for you.
At this moment, God feels magnanimous, expansive, congenial, beneficent, and philanthropic.
Philanthropic.
Screamers and Smurls. Our area has had its share of supernatural sightings and occurrences. We're no strangers to the paranormal. We have a group that searches for spirits and certifies haunted houses. A while back, I heard about the image of the Virgin Mary appearing on a basketball backboard in a burrow next to our depressed former coal town. It wasn't exactly the Song of Bernadette, and Mary apparently never spoke and warned the pickup team and curious neighbors to pray the rosary or advocate for world peace. The Blessed Virgin must have had an appearance scheduled elsewhere and moved on, leaving the local teens to their game and their devout elders to ponder the mysteries of the faith. Or take the case of the Suskin Screamer. Beneath the bridge on a road near a town several miles from ours, most famous for its annual tomato festival, and as the turf of a long-dead mafioso, there lives, or lived, if he has gone to his beastly reward, a creature whose screams pierce the night air. Debate rages over the nature of the screamer. Do the unearthly screams emanate from the ghost of a woman spurned by her lover, who hung herself beneath the bridge? Or were the sounds those of a hungry lion who escaped from a circus? Or is it some kind of creature, half man, half beast, a sort of coal country centaur, or yeti, or landlocked Loch Ness monster? There are, of course, tales of hearing the beast, or catching glimpses or half-glimpses as he scurries back into the woods. The near misses and almost encounters of Sasquatch hunters. Why is the beast screaming? Is he the last of his kind? Once he and his fellows romped through the woods, and now, after years of displacement, first by settlers, then miners, then suburbanites, he is the only one left and makes occasional forays like a bear getting in a backyard garbage can. Only there were other bears in the woods. The screamer is alone, and his is a cry of loneliness. The poor Suskin Screamer pines for a pal, or a Mrs. Screamer, to share his daily pleasures and sorrows. Not too far from the screamer's lair occurred the most notorious of our supernatural events, famous enough to become a TV movie. If that's not fame, what is? On a quiet street in a small town, it's always on a quiet street, just like the serial killer next door was always a quiet guy, the Smurl family found themselves besieged by a demon, if not the devil himself. It was our version of the Amityville Horror, the story of a Long Island home whose possession spurred news stories and a hit movie with James Brolin and Margot Kidder, who played Lois Lane in The Superman with Christopher Reeve. Rod Steiger played the on-call exorcist, but what I remember decades later are the flies which inflicted the home in swarms summoned by the demon to torture the family. The flies were enough to turn me off from seeing the sequel. The family in our version of Amityville complained of attacks on the family dog, strange sounds and odors, shaking mattresses, and various assaults. Except for the canine detail, many of these incidents were the stuff of standard demonic hauntings. The devil must follow a rulebook. The story was a mixture of classic haunted house lore and lingering pop culture interest in demonic possession brought about by the success of the book and movie The Exorcist. There were many news stories about the family's troubles. There were the true believers, and there were the skeptics. What better way to get to the bottom of this theological horror show than with the actor who played the exorcist in The Exorcist, our town's local hero, Jason Miller. Miller earned an Oscar nomination for his portrayal of Father Damien Karras, the doomed, doubting Jesuit who grapples with the devil himself and is hurled through a window and down a long flight of stairs to his death. Surely Jason could determine if the house was truly possessed. He was intimately acquainted with the devil. On his excursion to the house, Jason bought a childhood friend, Bob Curran, who was a reporter. Bob met Jason at a high school basketball game. They were on opposing teams and remained lifelong friends. Jason had a gift for friendship, as well as acting and writing. Bob had a long career, culminating in a Pulitzer Prize nomination for a story on abuses at a local mental hospital. His trip to the Smurls resulted in another coup, a best-selling book, The Haunting, which was made into the TV movie. Jeffrey DeMunn, one of those great character actors you know by sight but not name, played Mr. Smurl. The Smurls moved out of the house and into local history. The demon moved on as well, and the new owners never experienced paranormal activity. Their dog was safe. Jason suffered a heart attack and died in a downtown bar. And years later, Bob succumbed to Alzheimer's, an even scarier possession than what the Smurls endured. Bob's last story was a reminiscence of Jason for the Irish American, and the same could be said of him as he wrote of his friend. Demons aside, he had a good run.
fable. It is those who are complacent that glisten in the community at large marketplace, steal your face, as the plastic swiped recalibrates your economic value and viability. We glisten as does a turkey just baked for depraved consumption, bending the bow of an opulent table. Who drafted this American dream fable?
Aurora Borealis, the icy sky at night, paddles cut to water in a long and hurried flight from the white man to the fields of green and the homeland we've never seen. They killed us in our teepees and they cut our women down. They might have left some babies crying on the ground, but the fire sticks and the wagons come and the night falls on the setting sun. Massacred the buffalo, kitty corner from the bank, and the taxis run across my feet, and my eyes are turned to blanks, and my little box at the top of the stairs, with my Indian rug and a pipe to share. Sleep with Pocahontas and find out how she felt in the morning on the fields of green in the homeland we never seen.
And there you have it, episode 270 of Troubadours and Rock on Tours, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode possible. First and foremost, composer, librettist, extraordinaire, Richard Wargo. Thank you so much, sir, for sharing your insights and your passion with us on the program. I'd like to thank our associate producer, Dr. Michael Pavese, a.k.a. Uncle Cesare, for sharing another wonderful original essay. I also like to thank these musical artists: Django Reinhardt, Stefan Grappelli, Elvis Presley, The Band, Jeffrey Picon and Alicia Bernecki, Thelonious Monk, Neil Young, Terrence Blanchard, and Branford Marsalis II. Until next week, why don't you enjoy this one? Thanks so much for listening.